from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this half hour is made by the American Academy of Pediatrics, which has released new recommendations for preventing teen pregnancy. As always, they note that abstinence is the only method that is 100% effective. But for the first time, the Academy recommends that pediatricians discuss long-acting reversible contraceptives, LARCs, before other birth control methods. In particular, they tout the success of IUDs, with research showing that IUDs are safer and more effective than ever. It's been a long road to this point. The Dalkin Shield nearly destroyed the reputation of IUDs. In the 1970s, nearly 3 million American women used the Dalkin Shield IUD as a form of birth control, but the shield was found to cause serious injury to at least a rather significant percentage of users. That led to lawsuits, millions of dollars in damages, and in turn, Americans began to turn away from IUDs. But the Academy of Pediatrics says we've seen much safer, more effective advances since the Dalkin Shield. Now they want teenagers to consider IUDs ahead of the pill and condoms. Joining us to help explain is Dr. Catherine Greenberg, who practices adolescent medicine at UR Medicine's Golisano Children's Hospital. Dr. Greenberg, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, first, I hope the history is right, but the Dalkin Shield really did a lot of damage. And I'm not just talking about, unfortunately, the people who suffered from it directly. I'm talking about reputationally for IUDs.
Oh, absolutely. And it's really kind of a shame that IUD is used to describe both devices, because the Dalkin Shield couldn't look more different from the modern IUD. It couldn't be more different. But when I'm talking to young women, if their mothers, aunts, grandmothers had this experience back in the 1970s or 80s, it's colored their impressions and their sort of family stories around the IUD.
Okay. And so that Dalkin Shield looks very different. Give me a sense for the difference between that and the modern technology that is a technology, maybe the wrong way. I guess it is. It's a,
they call it an intrauterine system sometimes.
And what's the difference in terms of how it looks and how it functions?
Well, I can't speak to the function of the Dalkin Shield, actually, because it was before my time as a physician. But the Dalkin Shield.
Turns out there was no functionality. I'm mostly kidding.
It kept people from getting pregnant.
Yeah.
But also did some other things along the way.
Right.
The Dalkin Shield kind of looked like a fossil. It has a sort of fingery appearance. It's a flat, round device with some holes in the middle. It had a string that was braided that was thought to contribute to some of the infection concerns. Mm-hmm. And so I actually draw it out for patients in contrast to the modern IUDs, which I keep an example of on my keychain to show people, which is a simple T-shaped device. And if it's the Mirena or the levonorgestrel system, the stem of the T has some progesterone around it. And if it's the copper IUD, then the stem and the T of the IUD are wrapped in thin copper wire.
And when you're talking to patients or families or whoever it is now, mm-hmm. how often do they ask about the Dalkin Shield?
They don't reference the Dalkin Shield specifically. I don't hear that name a lot.
Yeah.
But certainly, I've heard about IUDs, or my grandmother had one of those, or my mother mm-hmm. had one mm-hmm. of those. There's just, because the IUD phrase is the same for both devices, it's more, I've heard of that.
And certainly the majority of teenagers who are sexually active are using condoms as their primary method of birth control. I think from the numbers I'm reading, and I've seen various sort of cited statistics, Washington Post said, more than 50% of sexually active teenagers, mm-hmm. Especially female teenagers, said condoms were what they used the last time they had sex. 31% said they used birth control pills. 12% said they used other hormonal methods. And again, is that about right from what you're hearing?
Yeah, that seems to be supported by most of the data we're getting, which the good news is we're getting the condom message out there, because certainly the AAP statement's really clear about promoting both a really effective means of birth control, like the IUD or the implant, and a condom to complete the sort of protection package with STD prevention as well.
Yeah, but just 4.5% of female teenagers are using long-acting devices. And that's according to the American College of OBGYN. So
yep.
4.5% is that you get a long way to go before you start making an impact with families that this is safe and sort of a better option than condoms and the pill.
Yes, for sure. And as far as efficacy at preventing pregnancy, they're definitely better at preventing pregnancy. And this is a really exciting time to be doing what I'm doing. This news from the AAP is great. It's in line with what we've known for a long time, which is that these are safe and effective for young women. It's in line with ACOG, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, who you just referenced, who said these should be first line for young women back in 2012. So all of this is sort of hopefully providing some impetus or creating some momentum and talking more and more about this. 4.5% is actually up significantly from a couple of years ago.
And you know, I have to admit, when I was looking up some of the numbers for today's program here, it's 82% effectiveness for condoms. Is that right? I always thought it was higher than that.
Well, when it comes to condoms for pregnancy prevention, unfortunately, because they have to be used consistently, effectively, every single time you have sex, then, yeah, the numbers for condoms in terms of pregnancy prevention are not as good as some of the other things. 80% is still, you know, 4 out of 5 times it'll prevent pregnancy. It's
better
than
nothing.
Well,
most people who are sexually active are probably having
right.
sex 5 times or more.
Well, I don't know those numbers, but sure. And one of the things that the AAP statement really talks about, too, is counseling young women about what we call tiers of efficacy. So starting to talk about birth control with those methods that are best at preventing pregnancy, like the IUD and the implant, mm-hmm. which are sort of 99%. And then talking about the birth control pill, the patch, the ring, and the shot, which were somewhere between 90 and 95%. Effective. And then next, talking about things like condoms only for pregnancy prevention, which is sort of in the 80 to 90% efficacy range. So we definitely recommend just letting young women know what their options are and putting those options in context of how good this is going to be at keeping you from getting pregnant if you don't want to be.
Are they surprised to hear that IUDs and implants are at the top?
I think they're surprised to hear about IUDs or implants, period, because
yeah.
it's not something that we do a lot of talking about. Whereas the image of the pill, or increasingly sort of the depo shot as like the default method, is sort of already there.
All right, so here's what I want to do. I want to kind of divide, again, that top tier as you described into mm-hmm. two, with IUDs and implants. Mm-hmm. With IUDs, the efficacy, what's the percentage?
Both the IUD and the implant are about 99% or greater.
99%.
Yeah.
And that's, obviously, that's got to be better than ever for IUDs.
Yes, the modern IUDs are fabulous. Better than getting your tubes tied in terms of preventing pregnancy, but then immediately reversible. So I take them out and I tell someone you can get pregnant today.
Wow. Okay. And I know that there are always listeners who are going to be sensitive to the notion of the way we talk to teenagers about mm-hmm. sex and prevention. So we'll back up and say that the first and best method is abstinence. And I know you make that
right.
point.
And I love that the AAP statement that just came out reinforces that what pediatricians are supposed to do, and I think this applies to anyone that provides primary care for kids, nurse practitioners, family doctors, is to counsel about healthy sexual health decision making. And so for a lot of young people, that does and should be abstinence, which is 100% effective at preventing pregnancy, preventing disease, but isn't something that young people can always stick to 100% of the time. So helping young people develop into healthy sexual beings and make the decision to become sexually active in a way that's healthy for them.
If we are, I want to ask this sort of as delicately as I can, but if we push an abstinence motif too far, does that risk shaming kids who are sexually active?
Shaming is an interesting term. I haven't thought about it in that context. One of the things that we do know from investigating like abstinence-only education in
yeah,
schools
right.
is that kids still become sexually active. They may delay, although the delay in most sort of studies is not very significant. It's a matter of a couple months. And they're less likely actually to use prevention methods. So we may, in that sense, I guess, maybe that's resulting from shame. So I've been taught to be abstinent. If I'm not going to do it, either I don't have the tools that I need to make healthy and responsible sexual decisions, or I'm going to do it in this sort of underground way where I don't protect myself from pregnancy or STDs.
And I'll save that conversation for a whole separate day, but I think abstinence-only education and whether or not it works, the research is not very favorable for the impact, unfortunately.
Right.
But
right.
again, we'll handle that on a separate day. Now, let's talk about the fact that, realistically, many teenagers end up becoming sexually active before they're no longer teenagers.
Yes.
And they probably think, again, as we've said, the pill and condoms. When you bring up IUDs and the implants, what are the first questions that come up?
I find young women to be really sort of intelligent consumers of birth control, actually. The young people that I talk to want to know, what are the side effects? How safe is mm-hmm. it? How does it go in? How will it come out? Will it affect my reproductive future? And even when I'm talking to young women about that, we kind of want to place this in the context of, do you see yourself being a parent someday? Kind of what is this big picture of choosing to become sexually active? How do you see that playing out for you for the next year, 3 years, however long?
We're talking to Dr. Catherine Greenberg, who practices adolescent medicine at UR Medicine's Golisano Children's Hospital, talking about the American Academy of Pediatrics' new recommendations for preventing teen pregnancy, which is an emphasis on LARCs, IUDs, and the implant. So when it comes to whether it could impact future desires to be reproductive? Yes or no?
No.
No impact.
These have no more long-term effect than anything else that we do. IUDs. The other fear about the Dalkon Shield in the past was that it would contribute to pelvic inflammatory disease, which could in turn lead to future fertility issues. When we talk about the modern IUD, when appropriately placed, if in the immediate post-placement period, there might be some increased risk of some infections, and that's just because we've put something into your uterus. And so if you got chlamydia the day after I put it in, for example, that might not be good. But long-term, big picture, after that sort of initial period, there's no more association between these IUDs and pelvic inflammatory disease or future infertility. They've actually done some really elegant studies in countries like Mexico, where the copper IUD has been the standard of birth control for a really long time, looking at fertility and finding that the copper IUD, again, is perfectly safe and doesn't have other things like getting a chlamydia infection affect your future fertility.
Wow.
But not the IUD.
I was not aware. So in Mexico, that's the number one method of birth control, IUD?
There are lots of countries where the IUD is much more heavily used. Most European countries have much higher rates of IUD use than we do. So we have safety data from around the world. We have global data in countries that have a higher rate of IUD usage than we have typically here in the States.
Okay. And people regularly I've seen online expressing concern when they hear that it's made partly with copper.
Mm-hmm.
No concern about copper?
Well, it's so funny what some people are concerned about, because a lot of women who wind up using the copper IUD want it because there's no hormones at all. So there are people who worry that the copper is unsafe. There are people who don't want hormones and so go
so
for the copper.
So they want the copper, yeah.
Because they don't want the hormones. Neither the progesterone in the Mirena IUD nor the copper in the copper T IUD really have a systematic effect. So if I measured the blood level of progesterone in someone who has a Mirena or the blood level of copper in someone who has a copper T, they wouldn't be any higher than another woman's. So they really work locally in the uterus, and they don't have much in the way of systemic effect.
And there's no, all right, so there's no special concern about copper. And forgive my ignorance then, but there's not just one kind of modern IUD?
There's two.
Those are the two.
Well, there's the progesterone-only ones, which is Mirena, and then more recently includes Skyla, which is very new on the market, and I don't have much experience with it yet, and then the copper IUD.
And you already mentioned that pelvic inflammation could happen sort of right away, but probably in terms of long-term inflammatory disease or...
Pelvic inflammatory disease is a condition where an infection that might otherwise be limited to the lower female reproductive organs kind of goes up into the uterus or the fallopian tubes. And so it's inflammation in those higher structures that can create scarring and infection and infertility concerns later on down the road. The risk of that is no higher with an IUD than... not using an IUD.
No special risk there. And I see the phone ringing, and I've been a bad host. I should have mentioned that if you have any questions or want to join the conversation with Dr. Reinberg, it's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. And let me ask Dave, our engineer. Dave, do we have that first line? I've probably already missed it. It's Gary. Let me go ahead and grab the call, and then we'll get back to some of the other questions we have about these methods. This is Gary. Gary, thanks for calling Connections. Go ahead.
Thank you, Evan. Thank you for having me on, and thank you, Doctor, for being here. I don't know if you had an opportunity to hear one of Evan's shows yesterday, but there was a woman on, and there were some callers that had questions about, especially particularly young women, adolescent women, teen women, receiving a medical advice in the areas that you're talking about today without parental knowledge. Could you clear some of those things up and maybe comment on why that would be? Thank you. I'll take your comments off the air.
Thanks, Gary. I think he's just asking what are the rules are. I mean, are parents involved, et cetera?
Yeah, well, this is a state-by-state thing. So I actually teach a lot of pediatric residents and tell them that if they practice in New York, what I'm telling them is accurate. But if they go elsewhere, they need to be familiar with their local laws. New York State does allow young women to consent for reproductive health services without notifying their parents. And the reason that New York State has done that is to encourage young women to seek services, because we think that if they were too afraid to involve their parents or weren't able to have that conversation, it's not that they wouldn't make sort of riskier sexual decisions, but they wouldn't feel comfortable talking to their doctor about it. So New York State does allow providers to provide confidential reproductive health care to young people. That being said, as a provider, I always try to involve parents. I think most decisions are made most healthily when parents are involved. Parents are their kids' best advocates. They're their kids' best decision makers. So I really, it's more rare than you would think to have to sort of provide those services in a surreptitious way or under that New York State law doing it confidentially. That being said, we do when we need to. And I also think as a parent, if my child didn't feel comfortable coming to me to talk about this stuff, I would still want her to have access to the most effective, safest, most appropriate methods.
Yeah, the flip side argument that you hear is that if you make those things available, kids will have more sex. The research has not borne that out.
Not at all.
And that has been studied.
Yes.
And that, again, the point of the way the law is structured here is simply that if kids are going to, I should say, if teenage girls are going to be having sex or going to be sexually active and they are not wanting to talk to their parents, telling them that they have to have their parents before they get these services is not a way to get them to stop having sex.
Exactly. We want young women to make healthy and responsible sexual health decisions. And if they're going to choose to become sexually active, I want them to have access to all of the things that they need to do so in a healthy and safe way.
When you say that you always want the parents involved, if you're talking to a teenage girl, do you say, I mean, how do you approach it? Do you say, hey, do you want to bring your parents? I mean, that can be touchy, mm-hmm. but how do you do that?
Well, I have a whole, when parents are there and if I ask them to leave the exam room, I say we're going to talk on our own because I think it's important that mm-hmm. Julie and I have a chance to speak mm-hmm. by ourselves for a little bit. And when the parents have left the room and we're having these discussions, we sort of feel out how her parents would react, what the relationship like is there. I find as a pediatrician, because I'm sort of a trusted intermediary sometimes between teen and parent, I can be a helpful person to sort of facilitate a conversation and on a lot of different things, sexual activity and sexuality being one of them. So I try to facilitate that kind of conversation whenever I can. But I also help young women make sort of healthy decisions and try to help them do what's right for them.
Okay. When it comes to other possible side effects or concerns, one that I had read about, again, I don't know if it's accurate or not, irregular menstrual patterns as a result?
Absolutely. Good question. It's one of the most important things that we talk about because with either the contraceptive implant or the Mirena IUD, you can have some irregular bleeding. Certainly there are other things we can do to control that if it's bothersome to the young woman. One of the nice things about the Mirena is that a lot of women, just because of the way it works within the uterus, have really, really light bleeding and sometimes no periods at all. The progesterone that's in the IUD does what we call stabilize the endometrial lining, which would normally come off in a period. And if it makes it real stable, it doesn't need to go anywhere. And so you can actually, up to 50% of women, by the time they've had that IUD in for 2 years, won't have a period at all, which for some women is a really desired side effect.
And 99% effective with an IUD, mm-hmm. but for the 1%, if there is a pregnancy, is there a greater risk of ectopic pregnancy?
That's a really great question because it's sort of a nuanced answer. Your overall risk of pregnancy, be it ectopic or intrauterine with an IUD, intrauterine meaning in the right place, ectopic meaning not in the right place, the overall risk of either kind of pregnancy is absolutely much lower than not using birth control at all or even other methods of birth control. If you get pregnant with an IUD in place, it is more likely to be, there's a higher likelihood than getting pregnant without an IUD in place that pregnancy would be in the wrong spot, would be an ectopic pregnancy. But your overall rate of ectopic pregnancy actually goes down with a Mirena because you're so much less likely to get pregnant in the first place.
In the first place. Interesting. Okay, a couple calls here for Dr. Greenberg. This is Danielle in Rochester. You're on with Dr. Catherine Greenberg. Danielle, thanks for calling.
No problem. Thank you for having me. I had just a quick question regarding hormonal birth control and read on the internet that there's the possibility of increased problems such as polycystic ovarian syndrome. Could the doctor talk a little bit if that's true or not? And I'll take the answer off here. Thank you.
Doctor?
Thank you. So the question's about contraception and polycystic ovarian syndrome. Hormonal contraception is a really, really broad category. So something like birth control pills are considered hormonal contraception, and those are actually used to treat polycystic ovarian syndrome. And so polycystic ovarian syndrome is in some ways an imbalance between your estrogen and progesterone, and giving that back in a stable way in the form of birth control pills can actually treat PCOS or polycystic ovarian syndrome. Things like the IUD or implant don't seem to cause that. There's nothing in the physiology, kind of how the medicines work, that would create PCOS. But what it can do is it doesn't replace that estrogen and progesterone in the way that the pill would. So if you switch to, if you have PCOS and you don't know it and you're on the birth control pill and you switch over to the IUD or the implant because you want the better contraceptive effect of either of those methods, there's the chance that it might kind of unmask PCOS because you're not getting that birth control pill. So there's lots of things. It's interesting. The internet is a wide and varied and wonderful place, and depending on where you're looking is helpful or not. There's lots of things that might people might attribute to the IUD, the implant, that are actually the absence of having the birth control pill. So if you've been on the pill for a long time and it's been sort of stabilizing things in some way, it's not that the IUD or the implant is creating it. It's that not having the pill is sort of making things show up.
Okay. Let's get this is Julie in Rochester. Go ahead, Julie.
Hi. Thank you. My question is about STD education, and as we are introducing these alternative forms of birth control, is that potentially decreasing the use of condoms and potentially increasing STD risks? Or I'm just wondering a little bit about that conversation and the education that's being offered.
Thanks, Julie. It's a great question.
It's a really great question. And whenever we introduce a new birth control technology, people have this concern. Luckily, because it's come up lots of times with new birth control methods, we've answered it pretty well in the literature. This seems to be that kids don't take more sexual risk, don't have more STDs, that we do a pretty good job about educating for condoms for birth control. I mean, for STD prevention. And so it doesn't seem to increase the risk of STDs, but it's absolutely always a question. And it's always important to me as a provider to say, this IUD, this implant is going to be the best thing at keeping you from getting pregnant, but you need to get regular STD testing, have your partners get tested, make sure that you're using condoms to protect yourself from the other stuff that goes along with sexual activity.
Does that answer your question, Julie?
Yes, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks. It's a great point, and it's one to sort of couple with this and always keep in mind. We've been focusing on IUDs, real briefly on implants. Mm-hmm. What's the difference in how long an IUD can last and be effective versus how long an implant can last?
The IUDs, the levonorgestrel one, the Mirena that we use a lot of, is 5 years. The copper IUD is actually up to 12 years. And again, both of those are up to, because you can certainly, as I said, take it out and get pregnant immediately. The implant is 3 years.
Let me ask a super ignorant question, maybe the most ignorant of the day. If you get a up to 12-year copper implant, do you set the clock and after 12 years you go back? Can you know if it's still effective? Is there any way to know that after 10 years it's not going to get to 12? I mean, how do you go about that?
In all honesty,
you did not laugh at the question.
I did not laugh at the question. No, so the copper IUD used to be 10 years, but then we studied it more, and the research showed that it was actually effective up to 12. Mm-hmm. The Mirena IUD is marketed at 5, but there's some evidence emerging that it might be good up to 7. So we're probably underestimating, honestly, how long they work in the interest of making sure that people choose a new device before they be at risk for pregnancy.
Okay, so if you end up with an implant up to 5 years, you probably want to make sure that you're cognizant of that as you approach that mark or even before.
Absolutely. All of these devices, because they have such a long activity, come with a little card. I think most of the manufacturers actually have like registries. Maybe they'll send you an email to remind you. But we figure out ways to kind of have reminders so that people don't go too long.
And online question about the cost. What about the cost of IUDs and implants?
So prior to the Affordable Care Act, or the newer mandate that all birth control be covered as women's preventative care, mm-hmm. there was a higher upfront cost to the implant and the IUD, which could have been keeping women from using them more accurately. They're really cost effective over the life of the device. Because if you think about it, if an IUD costs $500 or $700 and your pills are $20 a month in copay, actually by the time you get to the full life of the device, you might have saved some money. Hopefully, with the rollout of the Affordable Care Act and mandatory contraceptive coverage, it'll decrease cost as a barrier for young women. And we're actually lucky in New York that there is a Medicaid family planning benefit that covers all birth control free of cost. And you can actually use it in some cases with or on top of your insurance if your insurance isn't going to pay for birth control. And there are even sites in the city of Rochester like Planned Parenthood and Highland Family Planning, which is affiliated with the U of R, where they can provide same-day services under that program.
Let me get Kathleen and Aranda Coyd in. We got a few more minutes with Dr. Greenberg. Go ahead, Kathleen.
Hello. Good afternoon.
I'm really glad you're having this discussion, and I think it is important for all safe options for contraceptives to be discussed between women and their doctors. But lately, as there seems to be a push for IUDs, I feel like the birth control pill has been unfairly disparaged by a lot in the health community. I hear a lot of people saying that the effectiveness is so much lower, but that's really not exactly the case. That's with typical use, but with perfect use, or maybe even nearly perfect use, the statistics are almost identical. I also had a second question. Since the hormones in birth control work with they work with the bacteria in your gut, I was wondering if the increased use of antibiotics and also just the terrible low-fiber diet that a lot of Americans are on now might be contributing to a lot lower effectiveness than we could expect from the pill.
Thank you, Kathleen. Let's hit the second question first, if we could. Any knowledge on that?
Well, there used to be a lot of concern that certain antibiotics or other medications would make birth control pills less effective. We actually now know that that's limited to pretty specific types of medication, that most antibiotics are actually very safe with birth control pills.
Now, back to the first question. When you mention a birth control pill being around 90% effective, mm-hmm. that's where it is in the tier, does that include the people who are not consistent with taking it?
Well, and thank you so much for the question about perfect versus typical use, because I do think that that's a really important thing, and it's actually the way that I counsel. I mean, my job is to present teenagers with all of their options and have them choose the one that's right for them. And I actually say to teens, the method that's right for you is the one that you want to use. It's the one that you feel safe with. It's the one that you feel comfortable with. It's the one that you choose. Not what I would choose for you, not what your mom would choose for you, but the one that you're going to use consistently and correctly. And when I counsel, I actually have this chart that talks about typical versus perfect use. Perfect use, the caller is absolutely correct. If you can go home with a woman and make her take her pill every day at the same time, consistently and correctly, the numbers on birth control pills do look much better. But when we look at big picture populations, women aren't perfect. No human is perfect. And so taking it at the same time every single day, not missing a pill, not forgetting a pill, not being late with a pill is really pretty challenging.
What is technically late? Is it half an hour, 2 hours, five?
I think it's within 4 hours. There's
within
lots of books where I look these things up. I don't know if I need to know it specifically.
Okay, but the bottom line is if you are around the same time every day and you don't miss, the numbers change.
The numbers are better, absolutely. And I always present that sort of typical use versus perfect use data. And women know themselves. Even the young women that I see can say, oh, I'm not going to take a pill every day. Or, oh, no, I'm really good at the multivitamin, and I feel like
gotcha.
I could make that work. Women know what's right for them in their context, where they are.
Last quick question, then. For a woman who is either misses an entire day or misses by 12 hours or 6 or whatever, how long do you need to abstain to make sure you're safely back on it? A routine, and you're going to feel confident about the pill's efficacy.
You know, if individual women have questions about this stuff, I always urge them to talk to their doctor. If a woman really misses pills, like doesn't take it for a day or two, the typical thing that we talk about backup for is an additional week. So if you really have a break in your contraception, if that's the pill or the patch or the ring or you're late for your depo, again, talk to your individual provider. But we always say you should get back on the method consistently for a week and use some backup method like condoms or abstinence in that 7-day period.
We've gone over our allotted time with you only because we had so many interesting callers who had questions about this. And I think right now is the time to seize this moment and to continue the conversation. So thank you for sharing your time and your expertise, Dr. Greenberg. You're great. I appreciate really sending the message that the American Academy of Pediatrics has, as you say, come more in line with the research that you've known for a long time. Fair
to say?
Absolutely.
Then this is great news. It's fantastic for young women that the message is out from the AAP to say that these long-acting reversible contraceptive devices are safe, effective, and really appropriate for young women to use.
All right. We're going to take a short break. Coming back, talking about the enterovirus and continuing the conversation about health in our area. So stay with us on member-supported public radio. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and we want to welcome back to the program Dr. Jeffrey Weinberg, who is a pediatric infectious disease specialist at URMC. Dr. Weinberg, thank you for taking the time to come back on the program.
Well, thank you very much, Evan.
Well, I want to just... Oh, go ahead.
I'd just like to say I was listening to Dr. Greenberg, and I would second that antibiotics have been wrongly accused of interfering with birth control for quite some time. And it's very specific, very unusual antibiotics that are the problem that interact, not most of the ones that people are on.
Not antibiotics in general.
Antibiotics in general. Yeah, I just wanted to second her. I'm fully in support of that.
Very good. Well, we asked you to come on the program because, first of all, if you're just joining us, Dr. Weinberg was on the program a few weeks back talking about vaccinations and vaccination schedules. We had a lot of questions about that, and frankly, we had more questions that we could get to. But I also wanted to ask about the enterovirus because there have been a lot of questions in our community about what we are seeing and whether when we talk about enterovirus, if it is sort of a general term or if it's this, my understanding is, I don't know, is a more recent strain, the D68? I don't know.
D68. Yeah. Well, those are all good questions, and it's confusing because we're all confused too. So let me try and straighten it out. There are about 100 different enteroviruses. So enteroviruses are a big group or family of viruses, and they include some very nasty cousins like polioviruses, which are no longer in the Western Hemisphere, certainly no longer in the United States naturally because we've gotten rid of it by vaccination, but are still appearing in a few parts of the world. But then there are about 97 other enteroviruses, and they go by all sorts of names, coxsackievirus, enterovirus, echovirus, paracovirus. And there's a renaming underway with all of these, and a lot of them, to simplify things, we're just numbering now. So that's where enterovirus D68 comes in. It's from group D, and it's number 68. And we see enteroviruses every year at this time. These are the ones that usually cause the summertime colds, summertime fevers, a very common rash illness in children called hand, foot, and mouth disease, and then less commonly cause summertime viral meningitis. And recently, there has been this D68 strain that has swept the United States. And it's not that it's a new virus. It was actually discovered many years ago in California. It's just not one that comes around very much, as far as we can tell. And it has happened to come through the U.S. pretty big time this year, and it's causing mostly wheezing diseases in children who have had asthma or who have had wheezing before. And then just this weekend, there was a notice that some children were also getting motor weakness, not really paralysis like poliomyelitis used to do, but sort of nerve irritation and weakness. And these are things that enteroviruses are known to do. They just haven't been very commonly associated with D68. So the confusion is natural. It's because enteroviruses are always around in the summer, but our usual typing doesn't tell them apart. So now that we have more sophisticated typing, we know that D68 is around. And then these other problems that can happen with any of the enterovirus family, we think may be happening because of D68, but we don't have complete testing.
Okay, and so...
That's sort of uncomplicated.
That's the broad picture, you know, sort of distilling it a little probably too far. Is it right now a local concern for you?
Well, I think we have had a lot of we've had a lot of enteroviral illnesses. The pediatricians have seen a lot of hand, foot, and mouth disease, which is a rash and a fever that on the, as it says, in the hands, feet, mouth, sometimes the rear ends or the butts of the children in diapers, and then it'll go away. And we have also seen a lot of kids with wheezing get worse with their wheezing disease and come into the hospital. And we know that about somewhere around a third of the ones we've sent off to the state for more sophisticated testing, a third of the ones who look like they might have viral illness on the early testing that hospitals commonly do have been positive for the D68. And that's about the same rate as running in Buffalo and Syracuse, and indeed it's just in about every state of the country at the moment.
Go ahead.
So we have had the disease, we have had this virus infection locally. Whether it's worse than other of its cousin enteroviruses is hard to say yet. And doctors normally, including us even at the medical center, don't always test for all of these because it would take a lot of time and the parent's money and the child's specimens to figure out which of the hundreds of enteroviruses they are. And usually they get better, so we usually just have preliminary testing that says it might be an enterovirus or it is an enterovirus, but not. We have to do the specialized number testing, so to speak, at the state health department.
Is the media overhyping enterovirus this year?
Well, that's a very good question that I've wrestled with myself. I think that we do have enteroviruses every year. So in some small part, we say, what's the difference? We just have one that we know how to get its name. I think it might be a little more important than that because we just don't see D68 very much, so we don't have a huge experience of it. And it was a little bit of a surprise that it caused so much wheezing disease in kids with asthma because, as I said, usually most enteroviruses don't really spark the wheezing. They're more into fevers and rashes. So it's nice to publicize it, I think, because it may be something new. I think where it may get into hype is that we're all nervous about Ebola and all the terrible things happening in other parts of the world, and I think this isn't like that. This is just likely to be a pretty regular enterovirus. It may be acting differently. It certainly seems to be attacking a lot of kids, but it may just be because it's one of the lesser ones that comes around, so mostly we're not very immune to it, and therefore everybody's getting sick. But as far as we know, most people are recovering nicely.
So what is the basic rundown of what to look for as parents?
I think as parents, what I've been telling parents is do exactly what you do as parents. If your child is sick with breathing problems or wheezing, you need to talk to your doctor. We have a lot of good family physicians and pediatricians in this community particularly, so it's easy to say talk to your child's doctor. Obviously, if they're having severe trouble breathing, come to the emergency room. Or to talk to your doctor and possibly go to the emergency room, depending on the severity. We are not sure of this latest news report of the motor weakness with enterovirus. That is something that's known to happen with other numbered enteroviruses, and it may also happen with the D68. So, again, I think if a parent notices a child not walking well or stumbling or having clumsiness after what looked like otherwise an upper respiratory illness or cold, they should also be talking to their doctor. But I think these are things that parents hopefully would be doing anyway. So I don't think there's a lot different we need to do. The other thing we should always be doing, but sometimes we forget, is good hand washing. And that is hand washing with soap and water. If children are in a daycare or in a play group, washing the toys down afterwards, and keeping their kids away from people who seem to be sick. These are all pretty standard sounding advice items, but sometimes we forget the standard things are standard because they're good and they work. but they just don't seem very high tech, so they don't seem very fancy.
Yes, indeed. Actually, we've got some interesting listener questions here, and I'll touch on that. But I will also ask you, what will it take to get this country to actually wash its hands regularly? I mean, I don't know what we can ever do collectively.
Just keep publicizing it. I think the alcohol hand rinses are quite helpful because you don't have to have a sink around, and you don't even have to have paper towels. It happens that for enteroviruses, good old soap and water might be a tiny bit better, but I think the hand rubs are very good if you need to use them.
Well, and on that note, Dr. Weinberg, Dana writes into us asking, I've read that Purell might create stronger resistance. Is that true?
That's always a fear with some of these, with some of the soaps and things, the medicated soaps. Purell and the alcohol hand, that's certainly one brand, the most one of the more common brands of alcohol hand washes, they aren't likely to cause resistance because germs can't become resistant to alcohol, because alcohol is a pretty general sort of environmental poison for germs. Certainly some of the sort of antibiotic-like things that get put into plastic and toys and baby high chairs and things called triclosan, we don't think that's generating much resistance, but some of us are worried that overuse of that might cause some resistance to it. But none of the toys or dishes or baby bottles or anything have the usual antibiotics, so that we don't have to worry about usual resistance. We should be more worried about antibiotics in the agriculture and farm animals and things for that, which I would try and reduce.
We're talking to Dr. Jeffrey Weinberg, a pediatric infectious disease specialist with the URMC. And I ask the next question not to be alarmist, but just because I think it's probably a question a lot of people would have when they hear that right now, some cases, as you said, of sort of motor weakness or paralysis, maybe too strong a term, but some motor weakness is happening, and it may be connected to enterovirus D68. When you talk about the motor weakness, is there a concern that that would be permanent or just temporary along with the symptoms otherwise associated with enterovirus?
Well, I think as far as we know, we would expect it to be temporary. Now, this is hard because it's hard to predict the future, but based on the past, what we have seen with other enterovirus strains when they've been associated with weakness, those kids in general have gotten better. And this has been known for, you know, this has been reported for more than 50 years. Actually, if you go through the history of polio, which is the scarier cousins, most people who are infected with polio didn't get paralyzed either. It was only the minority. But of course, if they, the unfortunate few, including the late President Franklin Roosevelt, if they did get polio, they could have serious paralysis. Most of what we know about the enterovirus, those kids have weakness, not total paralysis, and they have improved. I can't say anything about the six cases that were reported this weekend in Colorado because I don't think we've gone long enough to know. But my expectation is that they would get better without permanent paralysis if it's acting like enteroviruses we've seen in the past.
And Jake asks, can the doctor explain how long the respiratory part of the disease lasts in those that actually get it?
Yes, that's a good question. It's usually just a matter of a few days to a week or so. You can actually pass enteroviruses out of your secretions, mostly out of nasal secretions and stool or feces. So we always talk about good hand washing even for the next couple of weeks after somebody has recovered. But in general, with older kids and adults who have, you know, who can wash their hands well, it's not a big problem. The biggest problem is in young children who are in diapers still, and hopefully most of us do wash our hands, and we should be washing our hands after we help them change their diapers.
Let me also ask you, you mentioned Ebola, and again, not to be alarmist, I'm just curious to know how someone in your position is evaluating Ebola from where we are in the world and the concern about where it goes next or doesn't, et cetera.
Well, that's a good question. I think all of us are pretty horrified to watch what's happening with Ebola. We've known for a long time it's a terrible virus, although a lot of the death, I think, is because it has struck traditionally in areas of the world that don't have a lot of sophisticated medical care. So I think we do see, even among the countries in West Africa now, those that have somewhat more capable medical health care systems have a little bit less of a fatality rate than those that are more struggling with their medical care. But the Centers for Disease Control and the professional societies here have asked people to be conscious of travelers. This isn't a disease that is easily spread through the air, or it's really going to come person to person. So, for example, the colleges and universities have been asked to be cognizant of where their students are coming from this year. And I think we're anybody who has a travel history to areas of the world which have had Ebola would be looked at more carefully. But I think otherwise, we're not too concerned with it breaking out or traveling around here.
I think that is probably comforting for a lot of people, because in some sense there's this view that the world is so connected now, Dr. Weinberg, that once you see an outbreak of Ebola, no matter where it is, that it will eventually travel. And you're saying, you know, not necessarily.
Not necessarily right off the bat, but we do worry about being a more connected world. We easily can have, the SARS outbreak showed us that. Remember, that was the respiratory virus.
Yeah.
It started in Asia, and actually one of the foci was in Toronto, where people had come back from Asia and brought it to Toronto, and it is pretty close to Rochester. And so we are an interconnected world, and we do have to be cognizant about what things are around. On the other hand, some of those, it depends on the germ. So the SARS virus, we were worried about traveling more through the air or through contact, whereas the Ebola virus, as far as we can tell, has really been in much, much closer person-to-person contact. So there is a worry that we're a more interconnected world now, but not all germs transmit in the same way. So things like influenza or SARS that can transmit in small droplets from coughs or sneezes are going to be more worrisome than things that have to travel through mosquitoes like dengue or chikungunya virus, which we're worried about in the Caribbean now, and Ebola, which at the moment we think is limited to Africa.
Is there any history that should suggest that Ebola will help that part of the world modernize their healthcare systems? And I ask that because everyone is horrified to see what's happening. And as you say, it's exacerbated by the substandard care.
Yeah.
Is there history that this sparks change?
That's an excellent question. I would hope that there is, that especially something that's not leaping to my head now.
Yeah.
I don't know of anything in specific. I mean, the terrible problems in Haiti were helped a lot when people went there after the earthquake, but as we know, cholera accidentally got started there, and now it's been hard to eliminate. I think hopefully with more, with just some basic supports and more infection prevention gloves, personal protective equipment in the hospitals, and knowledge of the population, hopefully we can prevent Ebola spread. Some of the problems with the spread are related to cultural practices of family contact with people who people who have recently died, and have to do with strong cultural traditions of washing the body or kissing the body goodbye. And those things are hard to change, and you hate to mess with people's culture, but unfortunately that type of contact can, if the person who just died passed away from Ebola, that's the type of contact that's going to pass it into their survivors.
Yeah. And Hans is asking, outside of Ebola, are there other concerns about anything that could spread our way?
I think the other one that people are curious about, or that we're wondering about, that seems to have quieted down at the moment, was the Middle East respiratory virus, or so-called MERS virus. This, we were worried, was related to the SARS virus. It is sort of biologically related, but it seems to be pretty focused on people in certain countries of the Middle East, many of whom may have had contact with camels. So I think there's a better feeling that the MERS virus is a bit more under control now. I mentioned chikungunya and dengue because they're sort of slowly coming north with mosquitoes. But when I say north, I don't mean our north coast. I mean Florida, coming along in the Caribbean. But I think we're always a little bit nervous that something may come around the corner, but there's nothing I'm totally tracking right now that that I'm personally concerned about.
Okay, and we've got about 40 seconds left. How are we doing on flu virus and vaccine supply, et cetera, this year?
I think we're just getting our vaccines in. We've started to have employee campaigns for our employees at URMC, and I see signs at many of the pharmacies around. So I believe we're in pretty good shape. I'm scheduled to get my flu vaccine tomorrow.
You're getting yours tomorrow. Okay.
Yep.
It's a good chance for you to remind us to get ours, I take it, Doctor. Dr. Jeffrey Weinberg, pediatric infectious disease specialist at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Always appreciate your expertise, and thanks for taking the time today, Dr. Weinberg.
Thank you very much, Evan.
All right. He's talking about a number of issues. And for me, some comforting news on enterovirus. It's a concern, the strain D68 that they're following, particularly with the half dozen cases or so they're following with regards to potential motor impairment. But he really sounds like they've got a good handle on it. And we ought to treat it the same way we treat all of our parenting decisions with our kids, which is be aware and get them help when they look like they may need it. I think I'm going to go wash my hands. In fact, I think I'm going to go wash this whole studio. Dave Campo, the engineer, let me ask you, when is the last time these surfaces were washed? On second thought, do not answer the question. I don't want to know. I am about to go wash everything in here as fast as I possibly can. Our thanks to Dave Campo, our engineer today, all of your calls and interaction, to the doctors who've been on the program, and the great discussion on business ethics the first hour. Very good day. Tomorrow, Rob Astorino, first hour. He's running for governor. He joins us at the first hour tomorrow, right here on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and thank you for listening to Member Supported Public Radio.